So, here in St. Paul, there's a wet snow falling, and it's not too cold. And this follows about 4 days of melting. We've had little rivers running through the streets. The days are getting longer, and the birds are really starting to sing. In the past couple days, I've heard a woodpecker and a cardinal and a hawk, and I saw a bald eagle soaring over Linwood Park nearby. More people are getting vaccinations, and everybody's turn will come before too long. At actual physical MZMC, they've poured the footings for the new Zendo. And the basement walls are next. And here at actual virtual MZMC, we're on a retreat. Some of us have been on a retreat. The rest of you, thanks so much for joining us. There are 14 of us. Some of us were here Friday evening and Saturday. Some are here for Friday evening, Saturday, and Sunday. And this is kind of a special, kind of an experimental retreat. You may have heard about it. I realized when I was planning this retreat that this could be the last all Zoom retreat I lead. I don't know how things are going to go, but I thought, why not take advantage of this and do something a little different? And so it's a flexible retreat. I've been thinking for a long time about how hard it can be for some folks to practice Zen when they have physical challenges. And I've had a lot of help with this. Great thanks to one of my students who will go unnamed for hours of discussions about this and a lot of education of me. So I thought I would try something new, a flexible retreat. It's kind of billed as a retreat for people who think they can't do retreats. So the flexibility comes in two ways. One is as to posture. We're home, we're on Zoom, we're not really going to bother anyone if we sit in a non-conventional posture. So it's okay to recline or lie flat on your back or even move from a chair to a cushion during the course of a sitting, or to just change your posture frequently, whatever you need to do. And the other way that it's flexible is schedule. We have a full schedule, but it's all optional. So if you'd like to take a period of Zazen off and do something else, that's fine. And that can help if you have, say, a back problem or something like that. And it also allows us to explore a little bit the interface between home practice and retreat practice. And I think it's gone pretty well. A number of folks are taking advantage of the flexibility in various ways, but it feels like an ordinary retreat. Nothing disruptive about it. I think maybe it's been, it's felt really warm and supportive, more so than some retreats are. You know, we tend to be a little austere during retreats, but we had a nice discussion after my Dharma talk yesterday. And folks shared various things. I'll just share one interesting thing. I said that I have this difficulty with my legs every single time when I sit in Burmese position. After 25 minutes, one of my legs goes asleep. And I mean, really asleep, like the circulation is cut off. And this has been a problem for me for a long time. And two people, or maybe it was three, said, I have the exact same problem and the exact same timing. 25 minutes in, my leg goes to sleep. I thought that was pretty interesting. So this is a really interesting experiment. I need to stress it's not a template for all Zoom retreats going forward. The next Zoom retreat, it will be up to the leader, the guide. So they may want to, go back to the usual, which is just fine. So Buddhism and Zen has proven very adaptable as it has moved from country to country. Doctrines change, practices change, how the community is organized has changed. In India, there were groups of wandering monks who wandered much of the year and stayed in one place during the rainy season, and they begged for a living. And in China, monks became self-sufficient by establishing monasteries in places, particularly mountain basins, where they could farm. In Japan, there are temples run by clergy serving the laity. There are monasteries, but the monasteries are for training. And in Japan, the monks were no longer celibate. And I'm sure there are exceptions to these. I'm really generalizing here. In the United States, we have many different Buddhist traditions here practicing side by side. We at MZMC follow the Japanese Soto Zen model, but it's evolving. The laity here is much more involved in meditation than in Japan. And some places are Americanizing the forms faster than others. And the change from the traditional Japanese model comes way too slowly for some folks and way too quickly for other folks. And hopefully for some people, it's just right. And we're kind of in the middle. Hopefully we're in that just right place. I really like tradition myself. Tradition honors the ancestors. And I think when practices have been developed over hundreds or even thousands of years to help us, it isn't wise to discard them for convenience or on some kind of a whim. I think we should be kind of slow to do that. And as someone who often deals with little issues like, should we change this line in this chant, or should we make this little change to Oryoki, I see how there's kind of an inertia. Things don't change so easily because there's all that tradition and so many people are affected and we have to change all the chant books and it's always complicated. So the inertia is kind of a mixed blessing. There's a beauty in it that in this community, we need to be aware of the effect of small changes. Because everything is interconnected, a small change can affect many, many people. So we need to be mindful. We need to see the interconnections. We don't want to make too many sudden moves. So that can be a really beautiful thing. And the Sangha is our teacher in that way. It can also be kind of frustrating. And there are almost always strong feelings, both for and against change, whatever it is. A little odd, maybe, in a community that accepts impermanence as a basic tenet, but we're human. Oh, so human. And also, we see the value of keeping things that work, that help us to end suffering. We have impermanence, we have constant change, and yet we have this beautiful tradition. And one tradition that is kind of a mixed blessing is rigorous upright sitting in a certain classic Zen posture. We have full, half, and quarter lotus. We have seiza and Burmese. So those are all a little different as to where you put your legs, but they all rely on a very straight back, upright sitting using a cushion or a bench. And maybe there's a kind of a hierarchy there that some folks think full lotus is the best, half lotus is next, quarter lotus is next, and the others are, you know, kind of down here. And good posture is revered in Zen tradition. And I think it's very important. And I think this classic Zen pose is really wonderful, and I prefer it. Because I think there's something about a straight back and a clear mind that go together. And I said this yesterday. I'm repeating a few things from yesterday, and I hope the folks in the retreat will indulge me on that, because I need to bring everybody into what's going on here. When my mind becomes especially focused, especially clear, my back just automatically straightens, like I'm pulled up. And if I realize I'm slumping and I straighten my back, my mind, I think, automatically becomes more clear. The two things go together. It's like they're not really different, the back and the mind. It's like it's one thing. So it can be a really beautiful thing, but it's not always possible. I can't always do it. So Japanese tradition is pretty strict about posture, and I've read tales of Westerners who have gone to Japan and had a real hard time kind of fitting in to the demands that are made. But the training in Japan was developed for young monks. As someone pointed out yesterday, the average age of the trainees in these monasteries is 23, and it's all guys. So what happens is you go to a temple like a Heiji, you have maybe 3 years of intense training, and then you go off to your own temple. So the training is for these young men, and it's great if you can do it. But here in the U.S., where everyone wants to meditate, we have a great variety of people doing this practice. We have older bodies. We have bodies that have sustained injuries. We have things like a history of trauma or anxiety that might make it hard to sit still in the classic way. So, and sometimes I think folks who find it hard to sit in that classic posture have felt excluded. So, is it okay for Zen practice to require a certain kind of body? Or can Zen adapt and change to make the practice more widely available? And does this start with our attitude regarding good health and bad health, good posture and bad posture, good bodies and bad bodies? To explore that, I'd like to go to a koan. I'd like to talk about case 83 from the Book of Equanimity, edited by Jerry Wick. And it's something we're using now for the advanced koans class, which I'm teaching with Andrea Martin. It's also known as the Book of Serenity. So case 83 is called Dogo's Nursing, and it's about sickness, but it can also apply to injury, physical or mental, or just the condition of the body that we're born with. I think anything that maybe makes life hard or sitting hard that we give a name to. So, I'll read this twice. Attention! Isan asked Dogo, "Where have you been?" Dogo said, "I've been nursing." Isan said, "How many people were sick?" Dogo replied, "Some are sick, some are not." Isan pursued, "Isn't it you who's not sick?" Dogo responded, "Sickness and non-sickness have nothing to do with it. Speak quickly, speak quickly." Isan remarked, "Even being able to say it misses entirely." So I'll go through that line by line, but I'd like to read it again. Attention, Isan asked Dogo, "Where have you been?" Dogo said, "I've been nursing." Isan said, "How many people were sick?" Dogo replied, "Some are sick, some are not." Isan pursued, "Isn't it you who's not sick?" Dogo responded, "Sickness and non-sickness have nothing to do with it. Speak quickly, speak quickly." Isan remarked, "Even being able to say it misses entirely." So, first part. Attention! All of the koans in the book start this way. Isn't that great? Maybe that's all they really need to say. But they do go on. Next line. Isan asked Dogo, "Where have you been?" I think that Isan is the teacher, and he's asking his student Dogo where he's been. We just had another case in our class called Kyozan Plants His Mattock, where Isan did the same thing with another student. He asked him, "Where did you come from?" So apparently Isan is in the habit of waylaying his students and asking them where they've been. And I think we can be sure that Isan isn't just making small talk and he isn't just checking up on them to make sure they're doing their job. He's inviting them to engage in Dharma discourse, or perhaps testing them to see whether they're embodying Zen practice. So I said, I think Isan is the teacher. I couldn't find anything to confirm that. And actually, Dogo does so well in this encounter that I wonder if they're equals somehow. Next line. Dogo said, "I've been nursing." That's a neutral answer, I think. He's just telling the truth. I've been out being a nurse. Dogo is not giving away too much. He has not failed the test so far. But then Isan asks, "How many people were sick?" This is the same thing that Isan said to Kyozan in the other koan. Kyozan said, "I've come from the fields," and Isan asked, "How many are in the fields?" So he's got this standard line, I guess. In the other koan, Kyozan responded aggressively, planting his mattock at Isan's feet and folding his arms on his chest. So that koan kind of went off in a different direction. But here, Dogo responds quite differently, more quietly. He says, "Some are sick, some are not." So maybe Isan is trying to lure him into giving a superficial answer, like 23 people were sick. But Dogo doesn't take the bait. He says, "Some are sick, some are not." And we can also surmise that Isan is trying to lure Dogo into revealing that he's trapped in dualistic thinking. When Isan asks how many people are sick, he's speaking with the assumption that a nurse only works with sick people, not with well people. There's a dualism that he's throwing at him. He's maybe trying to goad him into making a division in the world. There are people who are sick, and there are people who are not sick. But when Dogo says, "Some are sick, some are not," he is, again, not taking the bait. He's saying, "I nurse people. I'm not dividing them into the sick and the not sick." Then Isan pursued, "Isn't it you who's not sick?" He's coming back at him again. "Oh, Dogo, surely you see the division between the sick and the well. The people you treat are sick, but you're the well one." And maybe he's even trying to appeal to Dogo's ego a little bit here. "You're the well one, you're the savior, and you're somehow above the people you're saving, right? You're the healthy one." But Dogo comes back. Sickness and non-sickness have nothing to do with it. And here it is underlined. Probably by it, he's talking about that which is beyond division, that which cannot be spoken of, the fundamental nature of the universe, where difference and unity are merged. Sickness and non-sickness have nothing to do with it. So Dogo very forcefully rejects that dualistic view, as if to say maybe, "We're all sick," or "We're all not sick," or "This distinction is just not helpful at all." And then Dogo says to Isan, "Speak quickly, speak quickly." So Dogo has not only passed the test, he's now taking charge of the conversation, and he's turning the tables, and he's putting Isan on the spot. But Isan, of course, he knows what to do. He says the right thing. He's just been playing a part all along. Isan says, even being able to say it misses entirely. And Thomas Cleary's translation of that is, even if I could say anything, it would have no relation. So I think Isan is saying, there's nothing I could say right now that wouldn't be dualistic. You got me. Touché. So you can take the big view of this koan and say it's about dualism in general, and it certainly is. Jerry Wick does that when he says in his commentary that all kinds of sickness share the same root cause, the sickness caused by attachment to duality. But I think it's also helpful to look at this as being specifically about sickness and health, about the problems that are caused when we engage in dualistic thinking that goes like this. Some people are well and okay and normal, while others are sick and not okay and not normal. Because we are all sick and we are all healthy, it's all relative. Any division between those two things is arbitrary. We're all dying. We're all aging. We're all coming apart in some ways, and we're coming apart in other ways. As I get older, life just keeps getting better and better in a lot of ways, but there's a kind of deterioration going on too. And there are cycles of these things. Am I sick? Am I well? Okay, it's helpful in a medical setting to make those classifications, but they have nothing to do with it. Wick says, these categories are useful, but they are fabrications. Think of all the medical conditions that are classified as sicknesses, but bring wonderful things with them. If I didn't have some anxiety, I probably wouldn't be here in the Dharma seat. I am grateful for the anxiety that propelled me here. I had a dear friend and student who died of cancer who once said to me, cancer is the best thing that ever happened to me. And that student meant it. It brought focus. It brought a way to live life. Was that a sickness? Well, yes, and it was terrible, and it's helpful to classify it as a sickness for purposes of treatment. But ultimately, was it a sickness, or did it bring her a kind of wellness? And we all have physical strengths and physical weaknesses that we bring to Zazen. But who is to say that what we perceive as weaknesses are really strengths? Who is not to say that? If you suffer no adversity, are you going to be a better Zen student? And to say that some people have the right body and can do Zazen properly and others have the wrong body and can't do it properly is ridiculous. It's a fabrication. Everyone has exactly the right body they need to wake up. There is a way. And I'm saying that Zen, there are ways, kind of subtle ways, I think, that we at Zen Center and the tradition tell us that there are right bodies and wrong bodies. Sometimes it does, and sometimes we think it does. And I don't want to overdo this. I mean, there's a lot of understanding, and there's a lot of kindness, and there's a lot of effort to work these things out as well. But I think we need to acknowledge that there's this sort of strand of ableism that runs through it. I have a back injury myself, and I spoke about it in some detail yesterday, and it isn't nearly as bad as what a lot of people deal with, but I've been dealing with it since I had a car accident maybe 15 years ago. And after I had that accident, I had to sit in a chair for a year. I couldn't sit on a cushion. Gradually, I came back to a cushion. And I still sometimes need to sit in a chair because of my back, though the pain is much diminished. So that back injury has been a big focus of much of my attention in the Zendo for a long time now. And there were all of those times when I couldn't sit up straight. I couldn't do that thing. You know, I had to kind of hunch over or lean back or something like that. Has that somehow diminished my practice? Was that year in a chair a kind of second best practice? Of course it wasn't. And of course, dealing with the pain has in some ways helped my practice. My practice is what it is. We each have our own Dharma vehicle, our own body, and it is that Dharma vehicle that we can use to awaken. There is no second best. When it comes to the practice, you have the body you should have. Right or wrong, or good back or bad back, or sick or well, or injured or recovered, have nothing at all to do with it. A good question is, in light of all of this, in Zen, as it continues to adapt in the U.S., and really, if you look at the 2,500-year history of Buddhism, Buddhism has just arrived in the United States. It's brand new. Are we going to change some of the forms we use or make new opportunities available as we adapt? And my answer is, I don't know. This conversation is just beginning for me. But there is something I think we should look at now, which is a kind of fundamental reexamination of our views about able-bodiedness. The shift I would like to see is away from the idea that a certain style of upright sitting is ideal or best, and that everything else is second best. I would like to see us move toward the idea that the best body and the best posture is the body we're born with and is the posture that helps us to practice with that body. We're all going to get there. We're all going to deteriorate physically and need some adjustments. So let's ask, do we at times give the message that upright sitting on a cushion is the ideal, the default, the way it is supposed to be? Or do we want to give the message that the way you need to sit is the ideal, the default, and the way it's supposed to be? So we'll see what happens. Here's one little thing, just a small thing. Remember how a few people all said that their leg falls asleep after exactly 25 minutes? Well, I've come up with a solution for myself. This has been bugging me for years. I either tough it out and cut off the circulation, which I know can't be good for me, and have a hard time standing up at the end, or I move a little bit and I feel badly about it. Especially being the Zen master. I'm supposed to be perfect, right? So let me show you my solution, which I also showed in my talk yesterday. And to do that, I'm going to have to move. So there's going to be a little jiggling here. Moving over here to my Zafu. And there. So I sit in this Burmese posture, like this, nice and straight when I can, and a little less straight when that doesn't work for me. But it's this leg that falls asleep, And my solution is really simple. What I'm going to start doing is 25 minutes in, when my leg does that, I'm simply going to very quietly raise it like this, and I'm going to adopt a student's pose. This is an actual posture that I was taught years ago, where you clasp your hands around your knee. You raise one knee. I think it's called student's pose because you could take notes here if you wanted to on your knee. So I'm going to do that, and I'm going to hold that for probably about 1 minute, maybe wiggle my toes just a little bit, and very quietly put my leg back down. So no big deal. Probably no one's going to hear it. I don't think it's going to disturb anyone. And who knows, this may extend the amount of time I can sit on a cushion by a couple years or something. And I'm not going to feel badly about doing this, right? I'm just going to do it. And you can do this too. When we're back in the Zendo sitting, I think it's okay to very quietly make a small adjustment when you need to. Not every time you have a little discomfort. I mean, you can learn a lot from facing the discomfort. And it's not good to just move every time you have a little itch or something. But if you need to take care of your body, it's really just, it's okay. So that's what I have to say about this. And let me move a little closer. So I would love to hear from some of you anything about dualistic views of health and sickness, or about challenges you've faced with regard to your practice. Physical challenges, anything you'd like to offer to the group that you've learned?